Amen. All right, go ahead and be seated. Let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5. Thank you. We had a information age social networking first today. And the couple that was here this morning from Florida, I checked Facebook this afternoon, had 30 minutes, and so I spent about 10 minutes over there, wanted to catch up on something else. And they liked our church page on Facebook, which I know that in the big scheme of things, it doesn't mean anything. But it's nice when somebody pays your visit, and then they go look for you on Facebook and put on there, both husband and wife separately, liked our church. And so that's, if anybody happens to go by our Facebook page, there's just two more people that like it. And they're from Florida, so we probably never see them again, but they liked it. And that's a good thing. He said, do we have a sister church or whatever? When he introduced himself, I came through the door over here, and he had just come through the door over here, and he said, "Hello, Pastor Huff." Stuck out his hand. Brother Gunsman, I think is the last name anyway, but introduced himself and his wife. And I said, we're from so-and-so, Florida, Forest Hills Baptist Church in some city in Florida. I said, I used to visit sometimes Forest Hills Baptist Church in Atlanta. And he said, if we were in Atlanta, and he called the name of the church that they would be visiting in Atlanta. And some Grace Baptist Church of some sort. But anyway, I said, that's interesting. So I said, how'd you find? He said, "We just found you on the internet." And I don't know if that meant through Facebook or on the website, kjbbc.org. But I'll be talking a little bit about something related to that tonight. And this is the age of social networking. And so you want to make the most of it. And that's not everything in the message at all. But you do want to make the most of it. And because it is a face that the church has. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, though, thank you. Thanks for waiting that out because, I had to do something about that. we couldn't just kind of stay suspended. But 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse number 17, we're going to look at a few verses. But, this is the pastoral epistles. He's talking to Timothy about the management of the church and the ministry in the church. And there he says in verse 17, "Let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially they who labor in the word and doctrine." And then it mentions elders again in verse number 19. And we're not going to talk about what is an elder or the qualifications of elders, but simply just using this as a springboard for the fact that the very fact the Bible talks about such things as elders, pastors, deacons, officers in the church implies that there is some amount of organization into which God's people need to put themselves, arrange themselves, order themselves in order to do things. Again, God's not a God of haphazard ways of doing things. He does things in an orderly way. He didn't breathe on a pile of dirt and then watch it become a man. He formed Adam out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and he became a living soul. There's order there. I said, I just want God to come into it. Well, the best way to make it likely, and maybe not guaranteed, but you increase the likelihood of God coming into a thing if you organize that thing than if you don't. Although, again, our Gnostic thinking is very different from that. That's because we think like Gnostics too often. But, again, we live in a universe that is material. There's a spiritual and a material part to this thing. And when we're dealing with organization and organizations, we're very much in the physical part of it, not so much in the spiritual part of it. But we fail to realize sometimes how much the operation of the Spirit depends on the organization of the material. And we've been going through these nine marks of a healthy church. And if we're going to make a heading for each one of them, then we're a little bit ahead of ourselves. But let's go over them again. I know Brother Chang's been doing a good job in Sunday school bringing these up again. Now, I won't quiz you. I'll just tell you what they are. But first of all, expository preaching, which that does kind of give us the basic foundation of everything, which is how do we come at the Bible? Are we looking at the Bible as a set of, you know, again, loosely little aphorisms, little pithy phrases and fortune cookie sayings that are just scattered around that we have to read our Bibles through so they jump out at us now and then and give us something to preach about. If we don't read our Bibles, they won't jump out, and then we won't have anything to preach. So the goal is to read through as much of the Bible as you can, hoping that a fortune cookie saying will jump out at you, and then you can preach on that. That's not how it's done. It's done by delving into what is there and seeing what it says, where it says it, and handling it and presenting that faithfully. And that's what God requires, whether you like it or anybody else likes it, thinks it's good or doesn't think it's good. That's what God requires. So I'd say it's good whether anybody likes it. Then, again, that has to necessarily lead us into a biblical theology, because if you're properly exegeting a text, then you, instead of bringing things to the text, you're getting things out of the text. What's going to come out of that text are things to be believed about God and about the church and about the gospel and about mankind and about the future and about all sorts of things. Virtually everything that's of real importance the Bible speaks about in some way or another. And again, if we've got a biblical theology, then we're going to have a biblical gospel. Our gospel is going to be rooted in what we know to be true about God and what we know to be true about man, because we've actually let the Bible speak about those things. And again, even if it makes us uncomfortable or uneasy or somebody will call us a bad name, if we believe that, we still want to be in accordance with the Scriptures because of it. And that's going to lead to a biblical view of conversion, because, again, if you're preaching the gospel, then the gospel is going to result in people being saved, and that salvation, you're saved because of whatever gospel or whatever salvation is happening, whether it's genuine or false, is based on whether the gospel is genuine or false. A true gospel will result in true conversions. A false gospel will result in false conversions. And if we're preaching a false gospel and we're getting false conversions, then we're going to have a false practice of evangelism. We might even become like that guy that Dr. Mitchell timed on his watch that actually had a soul-winning encounter that ended in the person being saved in exactly 50 seconds. And that's obviously a false gospel and a false gospel presentation, a false view of conversion, false practice of evangelism. It may be the worst example I know of, but he told me he actually did time this kid, a student at some college I won't name, where he used to be a staff member, not a vice president. And it wasn't as bad where he was a vice president. But the one where he was a staff member, it was pretty bad for that sort of thing. And even some of the people there recognize that you got to draw the line somewhere on that stuff. And so, we've got to give the gospel and trust the gospel to do what the gospel does. And if we've got that wrong, it'll show up in the way that we go about trying to reach people. The next thing is church membership. Now, when we talked about the gospel, we talked about conversion, we talked about evangelism, because you can't say much about any of them without touching on the other ones. And so we kind of don't need to have three separate weeks on those things separately, but we could spend weeks and weeks and weeks on the three of them together. And then last Sunday night, I just began to open up the issue of church membership. And again, you know, I'm trying to follow this nine marks outline as is given by Mark Deaver. And what I've done is I've kind of taken the very, very, very rough outline at the beginning and tried to work from that with my own material. But when I got to that last one on church membership, I really wasn't satisfied at all with what was said on the front page. Now, you delve a little deeper, and there's a lot more that's available. But someone, and again, there's several articles on there, and again, it's not the only place to go for information about this, and it's not the only place I'm intending to go, and it's not the only time I've seen any of these things. But again, if we're going to go through the nine marks of healthy church, let's see, you know, kind of what everybody else that's talking about this is saying. And somebody came up with an article on the subject of meaningful membership, and I really like that. I wish I'd have come up with that one. Meaningful membership. Because it says quite a bit. It addresses the most important problem of all when it comes to membership, and that is members who don't act like they're members. Right? There are such things as people who are on a membership roll, and for all practical purposes, they really shouldn't be. In no way do they behave themselves like members. And it also provides a little steering, not a complete, you know, framework, but a little steering for dealing with the question about what do you do with people that, for all intents and purposes, are members in every respect, you know, what we would require from members. You say, you're going to be a member of this church. You got to have at least this much. And they say, okay, I've got all that, but I don't really want to be a member. They've got membership in every respect except for being on the rolls. Which raises the question of, how do you do church membership the right way? And it's easy to just fall back on conventional wisdom and prejudices and, you know, the stuff you heard before, and that's got to be right, bless God. But, you know, I've been down the road long enough here, 30-some years now. I've been saved and almost that long in the ministry since 1981. Really, 1982, actually, the first time I went full-time in the ministry. So, yeah, it'll be 30 years. And, you know, you have time to see maybe that all your real confident assumptions don't always quite work the way you think they're going to or the way you've been told they're going to. And when it comes to church membership, let's just lay down some things that are, I mean, this is absolutely, you got to have this. And that is, number one, you got to have agreement on essential doctrines. And again, I'm not expositing the word. I'm just the purpose of Sunday evenings right now. I'm trying to zero in on why we do or what we do and why we do it the way we do it. All right, Sunday morning, what do we believe and why do we believe it? Sunday evening, I'm trying to talk for a while until I need to take another direction. But for the time being, I really feel like we need to get addressing some of the things about why do we do what we do? What do we do and why do we do it? So that we all understand there's a purpose for these things. And sometimes Scripture is a better place to start. Sometimes it's not. But I'm not necessarily expositing the Bible as much as I am trying to explain some things and using the Bible to help give me the reasons why, or help give you the reasons why. And it seems to me, and it's not my idea originally, but I certainly think it makes sense, that one of the things that's essential for church membership is agreement on essential doctrines. Now, how many people are writing things down? How many have a pen and paper? Or you've got an electronic device and you are keying in some of this information? Because you really should. Okay, you really should. Maybe I should put it on PowerPoint for you, but somehow the church survived without PowerPoint for centuries. Amen? And it seemed like they worked with something else besides that. And I think it was ink or graphite and paper. And PowerPoint, as wonderful as it is, and as much as I'm not opposed to it, you can't take that home with you. Right? You can take paper home with you. And so I would say, there's some things. So why do you do what you do over there? I don't know. The preacher talked about it once, but I was half asleep. And so I don't remember any of it. We'll write it down. And then even if you are half asleep, you can look at it later. And one of the things, again, it seems to be indispensable in having agreement on essential doctrines is a well-designed statement of faith. Okay? And if you, again, the big heading here is there's got to be, for church membership, agreement on, and don't leave out the word, essential doctrines. Because the word essential is essential to understanding what I'm trying to say. Okay? If you leave out the word essential, we can stumble in a ditch. But a well-designed statement of faith is necessary for the church. And some people have talked about a church covenant, and I think that that's probably a good thing too. And that is, how do we cooperate with one another? But again, what the question that comes up now is, how much are you going to put in these things? And how many lines in the sand are you going to draw? And there's no question about it. There needs to be some things in these documents. They need to exist. The question is, when do they get too long? Because we've just decided to add thing after 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 thing that excludes people that maybe you don't really want to exclude. There are people you do want to exclude, and then there are people you don't want to exclude. And the question is, where do we draw that line? And here's the thing. We probably won't all agree exactly on where to draw the line all the way through such a document. If each one of us was to craft our own, we would all come up with something a little bit different. The question is, what can we come up with, or what do we have that we can agree upon and say, these things, eating budget, we don't want anybody to be a member of this church that doesn't agree with these things. If you can't agree to that, no way. We don't want you here. Other things, I may have a preference for myself, for my wife, for my children, for my even for people in leadership. That isn't necessarily something that I would want to say, I don't want you in this church if you don't agree with me on that detail. And so the size and the intensity of information and the restrictions that go into that document are a delicate matter. And that's why it's tough to bring it up and say it needs revision. But in fact, it does. Our statement of faith and our articles of faith and bylaws do need some revision. Not major overhaul, back to the drawing board, throw out everything and come up with something entirely different. But it is, and it's been time for revision for a while. And frankly, I've been dragging my heels about it because it's just a fight I didn't want to have. And I don't want to have it now. What I'd like to do now is get it through very smoothly. Brother Keck said something to me on the phone in the last couple of days, and he went through something very much like we did 12 years ago. And he said, I lost about 2/3 of my crowd and I've never got them back. He said, I missed the money and I missed the bodies and the building. He said, but one thing I really like about the way it is now, he said, it's really nice to be able to pastor in peace. And I'm enjoying pastoring in peace. I really am. I sweat the bills a little bit, but the Lord's come through so many times, I'm not sweating much. Although I'm sweating this month a little, but I think the Lord's able to come through again. And if He doesn't, He'll come through some other way. But I'm not worried about the Lord not being able to come through. But what I don't want to do is create a situation in our church where I'm not pastoring in peace anymore. What I would like to do is get something fixed that's slightly broken without having to wreck the enjoyment of pastoring in peace, which is why I want to talk to you about these things. Because if folks can't agree with what you believe and how you should live, then they probably don't belong in membership in the same church as you, right? And certainly don't belong in leadership in a church with you. I mean, if you say, well, I don't agree with them about this or that. Well, again, there are issues over which you divide, and there are issues over which you agree to disagree. And it's knowing where to make that distinction that requires grace, humility, I think wisdom, maybe some prayer about some particulars, but certainly to be a prayerful person. And that brings up not only the question of what do I believe, it brings up the question, what do I need to agree upon with everyone with whom I worship and serve on a regular basis? And you understand, you have to understand, the answer to those questions is going to be similar, but not the same. What do I believe is one thing. And there are a lot of things on that list of what do I believe that I cannot worship with someone or serve on a regular basis with someone that does not believe those things. If they don't believe that Jesus Christ is God, if they don't believe that God is the Trinity, if they don't believe that He was virgin born, I can't worship with them. Okay? And again, you don't have to be that bedrock about some of these things. I'm just saying, obviously, no leeway there. And then I'm probably going too far in the other direction, but there are people that have very seriously held convictions about skirt lengths and necklines and things like that. And I would say that, I think that those are things we need to have attention to. But mine may not come exactly where yours are, but I don't think that would prevent me from worshiping. It shouldn't prevent me from worshiping with you, unless you have no sense at all about it. Right? I mean, if you just got no concept of modesty whatsoever, well, yeah, then probably we shouldn't be worshiping together. If my idea of your concept of modesty is non-existent, then, yeah, we don't belong in the same church. Okay? But you're exactly as far as what you're comfortable with, within a couple inches of what I'm comfortable with us not being exactly on the same inch, but I'm not comfortable with somebody that just doesn't even think that there's no that there's any importance to it at all. So there's some things you can't budge on, and there are some things that you really need to be flexible about. And again, some people by nature just can't be flexible. I mean, they're right, and that's all there is to it, and everybody else needs to see it that way. And they can be very difficult people to try and get things passed. I mean, good things, not sneak by, but I mean, you know, just to get them to go, because their attitude is, you know, you can't lead and you don't want to follow, just obstruct, you know. It's just obstruct. But the deity of Christ, again, is a non-negotiable. The length of the tribulation period, the second, let me put it this way. The literal second coming of Christ is non-negotiable. He is coming again, and He's coming literally, physically, and visibly to the world. Okay? But such things as the time of the rapture. Okay? I know what I believe about that. But I would not say that if someone had a different view on that, that I wouldn't want to worship with them. That I wouldn't want them laboring together with me in the work of the gospel if their view of the time of the rapture is a little different from mine. The length of the tribulation period. You know, is it going to be exactly 7 years? Is it going to be 6 years and 3 months? Or are we already 3.5 years into the tribulation period? Frankly, none of that stuff really matters that much to me at all anymore anyway. As long as a person believes that Jesus Christ is coming literally, physically, and visibly to the world sometime in the future, and that it's not going to get better until He comes, it's going to get worse before He comes, yeah, then we agree on the part that we got to agree on. The rest of it, I'm not going to sweat it. I really don't feel like that is something that I want to spell out in such a way that someone that has a slightly different view from me would say, well, I can't go to church there. Now, again, if I got to see it the same way they do, I don't want them around either. You know, I say, well, you know, if you want to be mid-trib, fine. I'm not going to, you know, fine, whatever. We'll probably all find out there isn't even going to be one anyway. But whatever we find out about it is, you know, it's not as important as some of the other things in terms of cooperation. I would hate to cut myself off and cut ourselves off as a church option from some good people because of gnat straining. I don't want to throw open the doors to just anybody by not taking a stand on anything. That's not a good idea. I don't want to cut off good people by straining at gnats. And so again, say, well, you know, which side are you on? I'm trying to be on the side of common sense, reason, and humility that says we don't know everything. We may not have every last detail worked out. And, you know, it could be we're both wrong. And so I'm not going to go to church with somebody that's wrong, like I'm wrong about the same thing, just wrong in different ways. I think that's kind of stupid. And so that's why one of the things that's underway right now is a revision of our statement of faith and our constitution and bylaws. And the old one was not awful, but it has been in need of revision. And so what I've done is Christian Law Association has a recommended constitution. And the reason why, and again, your constitution is how you do business. That's what says, you know, we exist for these purposes, and this is how we do business. Okay? This is how we receive members. This is how we dismiss members. This is how we're organized. This is how we elect our officers. This is, and this is also the Articles of Faith, is this is what we believe about things. And the Christian Law Association has crafted, and part of the reason why they have is because for several decades now, they've been defending Baptist churches that have been taken to court over a number of issues. And they have noticed that occasionally the prosecuting attorney will bring out the church constitution and say, well, why don't you say you believe this, but why don't you do it? Or why do you do things differently? Or if you really think that's important, then why isn't it in your constitution? You say, you know, this is part of your faith, and when you're doing this, you're exercising your freedom of religion, and these are your religious convictions, but I can't find anything. I've read your constitution and articles of faith from cover to cover. I can't find that in there. If that's that important, why isn't it in there? And I think that that's a pretty good argument, really, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to make an appeal based on your legal right to do something under the First Amendment, and it's not in your Articles of Faith or your Constitution or anywhere, then it's like, well, you say you believe it now, and, you know, maybe you do, but it didn't matter enough to you to put it in your Constitution in advance. And so everything that they have seen as kind of, you know, hot-button issues or trigger issues because they were omitted in the Constitution and Articles of Faith, or things that are very complicated in some churches' Articles of Faith and practice, or excuse me, in their Constitution and bylaws, in other words, how they operate, that were provided liabilities, they've worded it and changed it and said, you're not obligated, you know, if you want CLA to defend you, to use their Constitution. But this is what they say. If you want us to defend you, then if you would use this Constitution in advance, it will make our job easier. It will make things easier for you if you are ever called into court over certain things like the operation of your Christian school and daycare or whatever. If you'll do these things, and it's not a violation of any of your convictions. And obviously they work with independent Baptists, and so they're very familiar with what Baptists can and cannot swallow. And so they've crafted this thing basically for Baptists. Now, again, the Constitution and bylaws that I've recommended, I've sent copies of it to the deacons and asked them to review it and approve it. It's basically the one that Christian Law Association has come up with. It's designed for our legal protection. The Articles of Faith is not exactly the same. Theirs is an adaptation of what I've gone back to, and that is the New Hampshire Confession. I've gone back to not the London Baptist Confession, which we're studying in Sunday school, because I think there are some controversial things in there. But not that I love the depth and the provocative level of thought that goes into that, but do I want to say to somebody, if we adopted the London Baptist Confession, I could probably force it through if I wanted to, but I don't want to. But if I did, then there's people who say, I can't subscribe to that. And I don't want to cut those people off if they can't subscribe to that. Because I think there's a lot of people that can't subscribe to that are good people that you would want in church. And I'm not so sure I completely subscribe to it. So, again, there's a couple of things I say, I'd have to change that. But I don't want to just say, this is ours and, you know, no, it's nobody else's and we just did our own thing here. I don't think that's wise. I think it's wise to go back to something that's established, is recognized, and that's being used elsewhere, and say this is it. This is our foundation here. And I think the New Hampshire Confession of Faith matches that. The only thing I've done differently than just sticking with the New Hampshire Confession is to import a couple of things that are stated in the London Baptist Confession in much more detail. For example, well, there's nothing in the New Hampshire Confession on good works. Nothing. There's nothing in there. There's, you know, it's of this, of that. And you go through the New Hampshire Confession, which is more recent than the London Baptist Confession. You look for of good works, and there's nothing there. And good works is a subject that people are very confused about. And so I wanted to explain in our Constitution what we believe good works are. We're not against good works. We're against the liberal modernistic idea that good works are something you do to get you to heaven. We're also against any idea that a person can pray the sinner's prayer and not have any good works and still have any kind of a testimony at all that they're converted. He said, there's no good works? Well, again, show me your faith by your works, James said. So if you say, no, we believe in good works. We're not against good works. We believe in good works. What do you mean by good works, and where do good works come from, and what is the purpose of good works? That needs to be spelled out. Well, the London Baptist Confession does that. It tells us what they are. It tells us where they come from. It tells us what their purpose is. In other words, what's the motivational imperative, what drives good works. That's all spelled out very well in the London Baptist Confession. Nothing in the New Hampshire about it. So I recommended that we put that in there. There's some other things, like, for example, a definition of marriage. Right? New Hampshire Confession doesn't have anything on what is marriage. The London Baptist Confession had nothing on defining marriage. You know why? It wasn't an issue in 1689. Right? It wasn't an issue in 1814, whenever the New Hampshire Confession was drafted and adopted. There wasn't an issue about marriage being between a man and a woman. And that homosexuality is deviant sexual behavior. Homosexuals need to be loved and dealt with just like every other sinner. It's just one more kind. Well, it's not more than just one more kind of sexual sin, but it is. It's sexual sin, just like adultery, fornication, and other kinds of sexual sin. It's a sexual sin. It's not just the way that you were made. If it's just the way that you were made, if that's going to be our defense, it's no wonder now that psychiatrists are beginning to say that people that are pedophiles, it's just the way they're made. And I mean, there's articles on that. I posted one on Facebook just the other day. I linked it. And so that's where we're going. If it's just God made me that way and I can't do anything about it, well, no, you know, God made me attracted to women. I've got one. Okay? Now, it may be that I would find women other than her attractive. But just because I find women other than her attractive doesn't mean I'm entitled to go after those women. Right? Any other guys ever attracted to anybody other than, you know, or ladies, you find yourself attracted to anybody that you weren't married to? But are you entitled to go after them is the question. It's not about what our appetites are. It's about what our boundaries are set by God. And so when it comes to the matter of sexuality and marriage and matters of separation church and state, there's some things in there that are added to the New Hampshire Confession. So whenever I could, I went with the New Hampshire Confession because it's an established Baptist confession that goes back centuries in North America. We go with that one whenever possible. I've added a couple of proof texts and a line here or there that I thought would help explain or clarify something. But basically it's the New Hampshire Confession with an additional statement on on good works from the London Baptist Confession, and then these recommended additions from the CLA Constitution concerning things that you don't want a lawyer saying, well, if that's important to you, why don't you put it in your Articles of Faith? You say it's a religious conviction that marriage is between a man and a woman, but it's not in your Articles of Faith. How much do you really believe it? Well, I want it in ours. Okay? Those things are important. And so I've submitted it to the deacons for their approval. And what I intend to do is as soon as we get done with these nine marks, and we're almost done, not done forever, but, you know, I mean, get through all nine, and we're number eight, right? What we're coming up on is really the last four in that discipline, discipleship, church membership, and plurality of elders that really all do kind of function together. And there's some things we need to probably pick up yet, but We're working on these last ones. What I'll do is starting in a couple of weeks, Sunday afternoons, and we'll get it in a bulletin that they need to be here if they care. But we'll put it up on the screen, line upon line. I'll go through it line upon line so we can vote upon it. I'll put copies in your hands, or we'll post it someplace where you can go and get it. Send me a best thing, probably do send me an email, and I can send you a PDF or a text. A copy of it on digital format that you can look at rather than spending a lot of money on paper and ink. And we'll go through it line by line, and it won't be for public debate. But if you have, I'll explain it. And if after I explain it, you have some great concern, then you talk to me. Okay? You come to me and say, I don't understand. Would you please explain that? And say, no big deal. That may not be exactly how I see it, but I can go to church with people that believe that way. Are you with me? Okay, it may not, and I guess maybe that's what I need to say a lot. It may not be exactly the way I see it, but I can go to church with people who see it that way, because I think I've worded it the way the majority would go and would agree with. And again, I'm trying to keep away from inflammatory and conflict creating wording, and say try to word it in such a way that people say, yeah, I can go with that. And you may want it more adamant. You may want it more detailed. You may want it more precise. You may want it more restrictive. You may want it more broad. The question isn't exactly what would you do or how do you want it. The question is, can you go to church with people that see it that way? Do you see it that way, close enough to that way, that, yeah, I can be a part of a church that sees it that way? You already do. You already do. The question, let's just get it in writing and get it done. Okay? Before, I don't think we need to let it go forever and ever and ever. So we'll put it on the screen. You'll have copies available to you that you can go through line by line. Because again, if we try to debate it on Sunday afternoons as we go through the process, this is not the Constitution of the United States. We're not creating something new. I don't want to split the church again over somebody wanting to make sure their pet doctrinal eccentricity is spelled out for everybody to either get right with God and agree with them or get out of the church. Okay? No, thank you. That's not what we need to do, is make sure everybody has a chance to define what everybody else needs to believe about everything else, or else they, and if they can't see it that way, they need to get right with God or get out of the church. I'm going to just say this. A good confession of faith will be worded in such a way that any conscientious believer of that denomination, obviously a Presbyterian isn't going to see it all like us, a Methodist isn't going to see it all like us, a Lutheran isn't going to see it all like us, but a Baptist. Okay, we're Baptists, not ashamed of that, we're happy about that. Okay, but any conscientious Baptist ought to be able to look at our Constitution and not find anything to disagree with in such a way as to make sure, you know, that put it this way, we don't want every subheading spelled out in detail in such a way that almost nobody could agree with it. We want every major thing to be spelled out in such a way that any Baptist could agree with it. I believe that that's a sensible and well-constructed statement of faith, that any conscientious Baptist would read that and say, I don't agree with that. And if they say, well, there's some things that I would include if I was doing it, yeah, but you're not doing it, so when you do it, you do whatever you want. You know, you make your own statement of faith for your house. But this is our house, and we've got to work together. And again, we are all individuals. And one of us is right about everything, and it's not you. Probably not me either. So it's right to take a stand for what is clear and uncontested in Christian doctrine. It is stupid and destructive to be contentious over what is not clear. Can anybody say amen over that? I'm not asking you to run the bases, okay? You know, but just, do you understand what I'm trying to say? What is clear and what is uncontested in Scripture must be stood for. What is not clear, what is contested, what good people, sound of mind, and diligent in study of your own denomination have different shades of opinion about, does not need to be spelled out in such a way as to make them say, those people are crazy. I can't believe that they want to divide over that. I can't be part of that church. Another thing that's recommended while we're on the subject of a statement of faith, and what is the heading? What's the big heading? Agreement on what? Yeah, while we're talking about agreement on essential doctrines, one of the other things that they recommend you ought to do, and I've heard this before, is to have a membership class. And in that membership class, and when I joined First Baptist of Riverdale, they let me join without attending the class, but they told me they wanted me to attend the class. You didn't have to attend the class. It wasn't mandatory. But if you want to get up to speed, and, you know, when you got 3,000 people and 30 buses and 10 vans going, you know, one little long-haired hippie upstart isn't going to rock the boat, right? So, you know, if I didn't like it, I was going to be gone eventually. So I can understand why they didn't make it mandatory, but I can understand why they did it. And in the membership class, which is, by the way, kind of what we're going to be doing on Sunday evenings here for a while, is basically kind of like a membership orientation class. We're all members, right? But hey, let's go over what we believe and why we believe it. And not to redo what Brother Chang's doing, but not only what we do, but also that would be very brief and very, very quick, not in detail analysis like he's doing, but why do we do what we do? Why do we operate and need to operate a certain way as a church? And so that's what we'll be doing in the PM service. And hopefully, you know, if the Lord blesses, we may be able to have a newcomers class or a new converts class or a new members class. When? I have no idea. But who will teach it? I have no idea. But it gets to the point where we need one, that those questions can be answered. Right? If we got enough going on to where we need one of those classes, the personnel will be there, and there'll be a time in the week where it can be done. It's not a necessity, but I think it's to our advantage to make sure that when people do want to identify with the church, they have an opportunity to be taught what it is that we believe. Another thing, and I just because I've got 15 minutes and I'm not going to take them all, but something else about church membership is secondly, careful and accurate record keeping. Okay? There has to be, first of all, agreement on essential doctrine. Essential doctrine. Secondly, and all I said was just under that, secondly, there has to be careful and accurate record keeping. And we don't do too badly. We do way better than we did in 1989 when I got here. Okay, when I got here in 1989, it was pathetic. And Mrs. Milligan did a great deal in tightening up those areas of our operation. And I really appreciate the effort that she put into just getting things, you know, running pretty smoothly and having a structure, something someone else could come in behind and follow. But one of the things we need to continue to do, we don't want to be lax about, is to require congregational approval of new members. When someone requests membership, you want to be able to have the congregation agree about that. Because admission into and exclusion from church membership is an act of the congregation. And here's where we need to get the rest of it's just been kind of common sense. You don't even really, there's nothing in the Bible that is there to prove it, and you don't need the Bible to prove it. But here in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse number 6, you probably don't even need the Bible to prove this, but it is in there because it says what 2 Corinthians chapter 2 about. Remember, anybody remember? They're dealing with that guy in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, the big scandal in the Corinthian church, right? It was a big, ugly scandal. We looked at this one last week. But there, he talks about how they dealt with it. You know, I told you to handle that, and you handled it. And he says there in verse number 6, sufficient to such a man is this punishment which was inflicted by the pastor. No, it says which was inflicted by the pastor and the deacons. No, it's of many, right? So what do you have there in verse number 6? You've got the congregation doing this. This is a congregational decision. Again, some people get from that the congregation, everything needs to be decided by the congregation, and they believe in a complete congregational democracy, and no, that's mob rule. Complete democracy is three lions and two lambs deciding what they're going to have for lunch. Okay? And that's not what we wanted, but we want to have rule of law. But there are things that the congregation needs to determine. And one of them is whether somebody's going to be allowed as a member. And the other one is whether they're not going to be allowed as a member any longer. We should explicitly affirm every member the church receives in and every member that the church sees off in good standing. Right? Not everybody leaves in good standing. But when they leave in good standing, and this is something we've never really done, but that is in your quarterly business meeting, is to say, okay, now the following people, you know, have left in good standing. Jeff and Ellen Gibbons family, they left in good standing. I have not yet received a request for membership, and I don't know that I will anytime real soon, but if things go well for them and they believe that that's where the Lord is indeed leading them, I'll eventually get a letter from Foundation Baptist Church out in Crystal Lake from Pastor Jeremy Houston requesting their transfer a letter. They weren't going to join the first Sunday, but they've been visiting some Sundays, and we've been going here on Sunday morning and there on Sunday night, and we don't know if we're being kept going by what we're getting on Sunday morning. And if we have to do without that, we may find out we don't have enough to keep us going and we're going to want to be back, but we want to give it a try. Is that okay? Sure, it's okay. It's 5 minutes from their house. We're 50 minutes from their house. It makes sense. I hate to lose them, but it makes a lot of sense. It really does. And so they're going to visit there for a while. And then if they say, yeah, this is where the Lord wants us and we're getting what we need out of church ourselves, you know, we're helping us and it's good for us, or we're helping them and it's good for us, I'll get that letter. And what needs to be done is that and we've never done it. It's just been one of those things just kind of been swept off to the side, but we should do it. And that is, I'll tell you that Jeff and Ellen Gibbons have been received as members of the Foundation Baptist Church in Crystal Lake when that time comes. I'm expecting it will, but It may not, so we don't know yet. But if I get that letter, I should read it to you and tell you that it's happened. And it doesn't mean we say, okay, by the way, so-and-so left the wrong way, and they're jerks, and I wouldn't transfer their letter no matter what. Because generally, when people leave like jerks, they don't request the letter anyway. Right? Seriously, they don't write back to the church and say, you know, we're joining such and such church, and that church requests a letter from our church, because they're not going to get a favorable letter in good standing. So, why would I? Why would I lie? I'm not going to lie. So I'm not going to send a letter to anybody that left in bad terms, saying that they left on good terms. They're not. They didn't leave on good terms, and that's why we don't get some requests for some letters. But we should require congregational approval of new members, and we should have congregational agreement about releasing the membership of our people to another church. This is not just my decision. It's my prerogative to write a nasty gram about them if they left and caused some problems, but it is not my decision to release them as members. It's not. I'm only one person when it comes to those things. And then the other thing is to publish an accurate membership directory. And Carrie does the best she can with the information she's given. And may I say, you know, it's not all on the secretary. It's not all on me, because people are funny at times, and they make it difficult sometimes to produce an accurate membership directory. They don't mean to make it difficult. They're not thinking about this is making things complicated. They're just doing their thing. Elder oversight is another thing that has to do with church membership. And again, there's a lot more to be said, but I wanted to get a few things said tonight, and I want to hurry. Every member should be in regular conversation with, and kind of under informal, if not formal, oversight by some elder. And by that, I mean some mature Christian in the congregation. They don't have to hold a title, although they're likely to, but they should be of that category, that quality of people. My personal, again, I'm not unique in my take on this, but I really believe that pastor is the function of a bishop. Bishop is the office that is held by people we call pastors, and that deacon is an office held by people that we call deacons. The qualifications are much the same. The duties are somewhat different, although there's overlap in the duties. There's a great deal of overlap in the qualifications. And I believe an elder is anybody who's qualified for either the office of deacon or elder, whether they are in that position in the church or not. Whether they actually hold office as a deacon or hold office as a pastor, if they meet the necessary qualifications and are fulfilling some kind of ministry in the body that is elderish, they're elders. Okay? They may not have a vote in the annual, you know, they may not be on the deacon cycle this year, but they still have elder function because they have elder qualification and they operate as elders. And that's, I think an elder is a generic term for any Christian who's qualified to step into the office of pastor and deacon, provided they have the gifts. And pastor takes a few more gifts than deacon does. But every member of the church should know and be in, you know, somewhat familiar relationship with some elder in the church. And those who function as elders, what they need to be doing is taking the initiative and getting to know what's going on in the lives of some of the people in the congregation. This isn't that large of a church. And I can keep up with most of what's going on, but I can't keep with everything going on in everybody's life. I can't. If I didn't have anything else to do, and I have some other things I got to do, but if I didn't have anything else to do, I still couldn't keep up with everything going on in everybody's life. And you may not click with me as well as you click with somebody else. And so, you know, the people who click well with me, I try to make sure I, you know, I'm close to them. If they don't click well with me, I try to steer them towards somebody that they would click with. Because it's not just my job. It's my job to be that close to some people, but it's not my job to be that close to everybody. And this is deacon duty as much as it is pastor duty. But it spills over into other members who aren't deacons, and maybe a little bit even onto people that aren't quite yet elders but are on their way to there. Because everybody should have somebody they're looking after. And those who are looking after the welfare of others should be in contact with me about how those folks are doing. I tried to organize it and it just didn't work. I mean, I really did. I tried to put that in place. You know, okay, we'll have you in head of the, I want you to look after this department. I want you to look after that department, this age group or this demographic group. I really like for you to be on top of it. And very few people really tried to do that job at all efficiently. So that was kind of, it turned into a disaster, really, honestly, to tell you the truth. So, you know, again, how do you do it? You just divide the congregation up alphabetically or geographically and say, these are your people. I really believe that healthy living things can function well enough to where somebody, you know, says, hey, that's a family that can use some attention. Gerard and Wilhelmina, Changs have kind of looked after them. You know, I mean, Brother Gerard really seemed to click with Brother Mike. And so he's, you know, and they're doing good. They've been coming faithfully now for several months. I suppose they're putting money in the plate and their attitudes are great. And so there they are, you know. And he doesn't dislike me, but he seemed to really click with Brother Chang. So, well, that, so I didn't have to sign Brother Chang to make sure they, you know. And I will suggest somebody, I want you to go meet them. I want you to go talk to them. I want you to go get to know them. And I would appreciate it if I do say, hey, there's a guy over there that needs to be talked to. There's two young men that were coming for a while. Nobody their age got to them, and they haven't been here in 3 weeks. I got to him. My wife got to him. Nobody their age got to him, and I'm disappointed that that's the way it went. I really wish somebody would have reached out to him, but nobody did. So they're gone, and we have to be attentive to those kinds of things. And so again, say, well, it's not my responsibility. Well, whose responsibility is it? Elder oversight is basically discipleship. If people are slipping, if people are in any kind of need and you're aware of that, you're supposed to bring that to me. So that if something I can do about it, I will do about it. There's a guy I got a call today or tomorrow. 11 o'clock on Saturday night when I found out wasn't the time to call him, but I got to call him today or tomorrow. See how he's doing. Just basically a how you doing call. If I didn't get the information I got from the person who gave me the information, I would just figure they missed it today. But they got a crisis, and I want to call them. Younger Christians need to become disciples of more mature Christians, and more mature Christians need to take less mature Christians under their wing. And every member of the church should be in multiple spiritually beneficial relationships, getting help from somebody further down the road and giving help to somebody not as far down the road. That's how it's supposed to work. That's discipleship, and it works into elder oversight because really they're kind of one and the same. Then finally, for tonight, limited service. Some activities and some areas of service need to be limited to members. And again, you know, here's where it gets a little touchy because here you got people that aren't on the membership roll, but they come regularly and they give money. And we're going to make a decision about money. And then there's other people that they don't come all that regularly and maybe they don't make any contribution financially and we're going to talk about money. Who should be voting? The people that don't give anything or the people who do give something? Or was it that their members, their name's on the roll and their name's isn't? I know these are things that I want to talk about so that maybe we can get these things rectified so that we don't have that kind of a question. It's not a question that we need to have anymore because the situation's been corrected. But generally, such things as business meetings, teaching, leading a small group, or unless it's an evangelistic team or something like that, generally those are limited to members. Members generally take care of those things, not non-members. And then you have corrective discipline. And I don't want to talk about that tonight because it's 3 o'clock, and it'll take a while to get through it if I start talking about it. But to me, the best argument in the New Testament for church membership is a matter of corrective discipline. Now, we saw just a little bit in 2 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 5, he tells them to deal with it. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, he talks about how it was handled by many. Punishment was inflicted by many. And then when you get to Hebrews, this is just a foretaste and I'll be done. But Hebrews 13, verse 7 and 17, those are the ones that talk about submitting to the elders. and that the elders are going to have to give an account. Now, the question is, what set of elders do you submit to? Okay? Now, again, there's some guys that take out the big pastoral authority club and, you know, they want to swing that around and dictate every area of your life. That's not it. That's not what those verses are saying. Yet, there is a statement about the need to be submissive to the elders. Where do you find those? Do people who attend Bible Baptist Church need to submit to the eldership of Harvest Bible Chapel? Well, they're elders, right? Do people who attend Bible Baptist Church need to submit to the elders at Good Shepherd LCMS Church? They're elders, right? No. Whose elders are they? They're the elders of the people that are members there, right? I am not responsible for the pastoral care of anybody who's not a member of my church. Now, I can extend myself and reach out and try to show the pure love of Christ to people that had a wonderful time laughing at my misery. Okay? I can do that. But I am not responsible to be their pastor. They have said, you're not my pastor. And I don't have any pastoral duties. I have Christian duties. So I don't have any pastoral duties. Okay? So these are differentiations that need to be made. So there is such a thing as submitting to elders. There is such a thing as elders giving an account. We'll not look at it closely, but I'm just pointing it out now. You say, well, prove that church membership's in the Bible. Well, how? It doesn't say you must join a church. But how in the world do verses like that make any sense at all? Unless there is some kind of formal association with and recognition of, because if someone, you know, they're in this church for 4 weeks, or they're in this church 1 week and another church another week, and they bounce around, then really what elders are they submissive to? And who's going to give an account for them? Who's going to stand before God and say, you know, I did or did not care for them, or I did or did not preach to them what they came, they supported, they took part, they participated, and I really failed in my job as pastor to them, or I did the best I could, being the sinner that I am with the limitations that I had, to deliver them the Word of God faithfully. If they're not here for more than 4 weeks and never formally associate, and then they're here, and then they're there, and then they're there, then they're there, that's on them. That's not on me, right? It's not on us. But if we're going to say, now this is my church and this is where I want to be, and sooner or later, I think every Christian, okay, you need a little time to decide, but I think sooner or later, every Christian needs to decide, this is where I'm going to identify myself, and I'm going to submit to it, and I'm going to be a part of it. And again, that doesn't mean that I have to agree with everybody else in this congregation about every last detail, about every last thing, but I am in agreement with certain doctrinal essentials. And I do believe that this is a good way to operate. And these are things that every Christian that I want to be associated with has to agree on at least these things. The rest of it, we can have differences of opinion. But yes, we agree on these things. And those things are the things I can't give up. And they can't either. And that's enough. That's enough. I can't give up on these. They can't give up on them either. We're in agreement on those things. That's enough. The rest of it doesn't really matter. You're free to your opinion. I'm free to mine. This is a good way to operate, and this is a good place to serve, and I believe in what's happening here, and I'm committed to it. And when people make that commitment, then you say to them, all right, then we want to be here for you. And again, how do you get them to make that commitment? Well, you be there for them if they seem to be inclined in that direction. You want to be there for them. You want to welcome when they come in the door so that they come back and start to be inclined to identify. Those are things we have to do. But corrective, when we get to corrective discipline, elder rule, or excuse me, the elder function, what the elders do, and the function of church discipline, absolutely make no sense at all unless there is such a thing as identification with the church. Again, how is that made? We have in law, civil law. What is it? Common law marriage? Right? And, you know, they live together 10 years and have 5 kids, and he dies, and they never have a marriage license, never have a ceremony. She still gets everything, right? Because it's common law. And I'm not saying that let's just default to common law church membership. But sometimes it's like, you know, whether you want to or not, buddy, this is your church home. You know, whatever your little weird hang up is about church membership, this is your church home and we're going to treat you like it. And you know, you may or may not be in agreement with it, but I don't know why it would be better to not treat them like it under those circumstances, because the arrangement exists whether it's on paper or not. But the best thing to do is to get it on paper. I understand. So I've talked a long time and it hasn't been, you know, real stimulating, but you need to know these things. And so that's where we are. And there's got to be a time to talk about them. So tonight is a start.